case is 18-6007, N. Ray Johnny M. Blue, etc., Bianca Rucker versus Johnny M. Blue.
Just like code section that is never mentioned during the proceeding before me, and it's never argued as the grounds for relief. I'm a little bit troubled by the assertion that because everything's in there, if you just sort of sift through it carefully enough, you can put together a 522G claim. How is it fair to the bankruptcy court for you to be arguing to us that 522G would afford the trustee relief when that was never argued to the bankruptcy court in the first instance?
I understand, Your Honor. Law versus Single wasn't mentioned to the trustee either. The trustee did not have a chance at the trial level to respond to the Law versus Single argument. Didn't even raise 522G. I didn't think I needed it because I got bad faith all over it. It's pretty bloody here, Your Honor.
You just tried to bring the case for bad faith. Don't misunderstand me. I'm trying to focus on what we're appropriately going to consider, and one of our cardinal rules is we don't consider arguments that were raised in the bankruptcy court in the first instance. Now, the bad faith issue, that's your plea, directly to plead with discussions of bad faith, and that the claim is not made on because of bad faith. I am seriously concerned about the 522G argument.
Trustee did not mention 522G. She did argue the elements. But she did not mention 522G.
And you say she argued the elements in the beyond, which I feel like I'm picking on you, but I want to be very precise here. She didn't argue them as elements of 522G. She argued things that could be constructed into the 522G argument. Would that be more fair to say?
I think it's a matter of interpretation, but she was objecting to the exhibit. Not only was she objecting to the fact that the debtor was filing an amended claim of exemptions when there was bad faith and that there was prejudice to creditors, but she was objecting to claiming the cash is exempt. And on the basis that she was objecting to the specific fact that the cash was being claimed as exempt. And in the Kalin case, the Eighth Circuit Kalin case that is all over the briefing, Judge Malloy pointed out that there are two issues here. The first issue is, does the debtor have the right to amend the schedules procedurally under 109A? And if the debtor does have the right, then are the amended exemptions that are claimed in conformity with 522? Is there an objection under 522? That's what Judge Malloy, that's what the Eighth Circuit panel in the Kalin case ruled, consistent with so many other courts, including some of your decisions, have held that the right to amend under 109A is not absolute, but is subject to the court's discretion in the event the amendment is proposed in bad faith or with prejudice creditors.
So do we treat the amendment to Schedule C as a motion to amend then that needs to be addressed? You amend the Schedule AB to include the asset so that it's disclosed. And then under 109A, the debtor is allowed to amend Schedule C. When an amendment to Schedule C is filed, is that final subject to objection, or is it just a request by the debtor that they're able to amend Schedule C?
Well, I think we know that if the debtor amends the schedule to claim additional exemptions and if it's not objected to, then the exemptions are deemed allowed and anybody won't object.
I guess the one thing I'm thinking about is when you make a motion to amend a complaint or a motion to amend in a different type of setting, you know, that's a motion to amend that can be objected to. Is that really what we have here as opposed to an exemption issue?
I think that's what we have. I think it's not filed as a motion, but I believe that based on the rules, based on the way the courts have interpreted them, it's in essence a motion to amend. And if nobody objects, the motion is granted. similar to in local practice here in Chapter 75 of the motion for Lincoln State, the court issues a negative notice and nobody objects, the motion's granted. There's not a negative notice in this context, but if no one responds to the amended claim of exemptions, they are deemed allowed. But under the case law, that it is subject to bad faith and prejudice to creditors. In the post-single case of In re Ventura out of the Northern District of Iowa, the bankruptcy court, and that was not Judge Shaleen's case, the bankruptcy court ruled that the right to amend exemptions under 109A is subject to bad faith and the prejudice to creditors exception. In that case, it's important to note that the trustee, at the time of the exemption, amended exemption, the trustee had already sold the asset that the debtor was attempting to claim as exempt.
Your rebuttal time is starting. Welcome to keep going.
I see that. And the court denied the amendment. And that demonstrates the problem with interpreting Long versus Siegel as having an unlimited right, an unfettered right to amend the exemptions. Because the debtor can amend the exemptions all through the case, and there's no limitation on it. Who's to say in this particular case that the debtor is not going to go out and, if he gets the cash now, $15,000, it's exempt, he goes out and spends the cash, and then 6 months later he wants to amend again. Other assets. And we could always file a motion to dismiss or object to his discharge, but that's probably run. But so then you have a debtor out there who's under the protection of the court, has spent all his money, and the creditors are at a loss. And he's made a mockery of the court, made a mockery of the bankruptcy code, and the bankruptcy system. I'll pass.
Mr. Hertzer.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for hearing us today. I think before this panel is a very important issue. I am a consumer bankruptcy attorney. I do Chapter 7s and Chapter 13s and Chapter 12s. I don't represent creditors. In Chapter 11. And so this is what I would tell you from my practice. I've been doing nothing but consumer bankruptcy law for 10 years. Last year, in 2017, I filed 92 cases. I'm not a volume filer. I don't advertise. But in 92 cases, 52 of which were Chapter 7s, I spent on average about 4 hours with each debtor before we filed a bankruptcy petition. But notwithstanding that, in general, in practice, there will be times when a consumer debtor fails to disclose something on Schedule B because they just missed it. It was inadvertently omitted. For instance, just recently, I had a debtor tell me that he had no idea that a non-vested stock option would be something that he would list on Schedule B because
a non-vested stock option is a whole lot different than $30,000 in the deposit counsel, and I guess the bankruptcy judge didn't have an opportunity to make any credibility finding, or didn't, I should say, make any credibility finding, which is really what that goes to. Isn't that correct? I mean, we don't have a decision about his thoughts on that issue.
Correct, Judge Shaleen. The court, after hearing almost two days of testimony with the debtor being on the stand for hours being questioned, the judge made no finding as to good faith or bad faith. And the documents filed, the brief and so forth, almost assumes bad faith in the statements that there absolutely is bad faith.
We all recognize this case does not really indicate whether a debtor has the right to amend or not. Can we go there?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, I will tell you that the day I tried this in the bankruptcy court, I did not know that law v. Siegel existed. I told after Judge Barry issued his order and we prevailed, I told my debtor that he should fire me because I did not know what to argue that law v. Siegel even existed. But now I do. And law v. Siegel seems to leave no open door for somehow under what the court's 105 powers to carve out an exception to the right to exempt property that is not in 522. But I don't know if...
So let me stop you there. Because obviously, as Judge Selyam said, the bankruptcy court did not make findings of bad faith or good faith. So we don't know if the bankruptcy court would have thought about your client's credibility, whether this was an honest mistake, such as an uninvested pension, or if it was $30,000 cash in the safe in the house. Okay. Have a difficult time believing I would forget $30,000 in cash in the safe in my house, but it could happen.
But we're not making credibility.
But we're not there. So what it comes to me is your argument that under law v. Siegel, even if the bankruptcy court had found that your client, again, no such findings were made, if the bankruptcy court had found that your client did act in bad faith, did know about the cash in the safe, intentionally withheld knowledge of that cash in the safe, and intentionally misled you, trustee, court, if all of that were found by the bankruptcy court, is it your position under law v. Siegel, there's nothing that can be done about it in terms of his claiming those funds exempt? He can do all of that, he can amend after he's discovered, he can claim it exempt, and there's nothing that can be done by the bankruptcy court with respect to that claim of exemption.
Your Honor, I do believe that on multiple readings of law v. Siegel since the decision of Judge Barry, that is what law v. Siegel would teach or hold. The appellant does their best to carve out that there's a difference between objecting to an amended claim of exemptions and the equitable surcharge.
There is a distinction because in law v. Siegel, the exemption had become final and the debtor had an interest in the property. In the situation before us, the cash is property of the estate. And I think what the appellant is arguing is it's the ability to amend Schedule C, the claim that is exempt, which is at issue. And until that exemption is decided, isn't that something that's subject to the court's jurisdiction under 522?
And Judge, my response would be that the U.S. Supreme Court, it looked at a fact pattern that was egregious and said your exemptions are sacrosanct.
But only because no objection had been filed. There was no objection to the exemption claimed in law versus C.
But Judge, I mean, Judge Scalia for the court brings that issue up a couple different times in the decision and says that even if this was an objection to exemptions on an amendment, we see no difference. Now, appellant has to argue that that's dicta, that that's not the core holding. I counted the number of times that surcharge or equitable surcharge appears in that opinion. It appears 9 times. The number of times exemption or exempt appears is 49 times. This is clearly an opinion about the impenetrability of the exemptions that Congress allowed in the statute. See if I can get back on track here. Thank you. disparity of ability for a trustee, and in some events, an overly aggressive Chapter 7 trustee to object to amended exemptions, because that puts the debtor in a very difficult position. Usually, Chapter 7 debtors are without a lot of resources. I told my clients it's one time in life where it's good to be dirt poor, and most of them are at the time they file Chapter 7. And if somebody had omitted, maybe my non-vested stock option is an extreme example, but there would be other things that sometimes a very honest debtor might not disclose and need to amend to add. At that point, if the trustee can object to those exemptions, that's easy for a Chapter 7 trustee to do.
I'm a little confused by what happened in this case, because if you're arguing that Mr. Liu is an honest debtor, which is fine because we have an credibility evaluation, but then why did he give only half the money? I mean, is it all his? Is it all his wife's? Or why? I guess I'm confused as to how you came up with that turnover. Was that really a motion to compromise and just didn't get finalized?
No, not exactly. This is a second marriage for both of them. They've not been living together.
Well, I'm just asking why you turned over $15,000 to the bankruptcy trustee as opposed to nothing, or as opposed to $30,000.
It would be our position that Mr. Ballou is the one who shined a light on this home safe cash when he realized or remembered at 70 years of age that the genesis of the cash had something to do with his income from 2 or 3 years ago that was deposited into a bank account. And it was a bank account that then was closed one to 2 years before the bankruptcy was filed.
So
turned into home safe cash. So what we disclosed, Your Honor, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
So by turning over $15,000, is that an admission that belongs to the estate and it's not exempt?
What it is an admission of is that the amount of money in that home safe that was attributable to him versus the amount of money that was attributable to his wife was indeterminate. And so since it was indeterminate, the amended Schedule B says we don't know what portion is his, what portion is hers. We're just going to cut it in half. On the day the bankruptcy petition was filed, it was $30,000. So we're going to say it was unknown, but $15,000 is half of it. And so we're going to disclose $15,000 and amend or to exempt what was left in the D-5, which was $12,000 and change. So it would be beyond ability to determine what part of that $30,000 that was in the home safe was attributable to her private source of funds before they were married, and what source was attributable to him.
So my question is he admitting that $15,000 is not exempt?
He's admitting that $15,000 is part of the bankruptcy estate, and he is asserting an exemption of the D-5 remaining that he could exempt. Sorry that I didn't get that.
So if we can get back to Hobby Siegel for a minute. Sorry. Yes, I think that's what this case determines. So it's your position, Hobby Siegel applies, that the debtor can amend his schedules regardless of any fraudulent intent, concealment, etc. How does, in your mind, 522D fit in all of this stuff? Because didn't Hobby Siegel say the bankruptcy court can't use its inherent powers or equitable powers to withhold the exemption, but it can only use whatever is based in statute and isn't 522 based in statute?
In 522G, it appears not to be appropriate in this case, because the 522G predicate is that the trustee recovered funds under certain code sections, and it would be the appellee's position here is that this was a effort to show good faith here trustee never asked about home safe cash. The trustee had no idea that there was home safe cash. The trustee was doing a really good job of due diligence looking at the whole of Mr. Ballou's world, but the trustee had no idea that there was a home safe or home safe cash until the day the schedules were, amended schedules were filed, and subsequently at a deposition it was agreed that...
Unless the trustee chasing a $30,000+ withdrawal at the time trying to figure out where...
No, Your Honor.
That was the impression that the brief stated.
Yeah, it's absolutely...
That's not correct.
That's not correct. There was no $30,000 withdrawal.
On the subject of 522G, I asked Mr. Coleman, I'll ask you, was the objection based on the 522G, right?
No. The trustee's objection?
Correct. No. The objection was tried. Was there any reference to mention?
Both the trustee and I both tried the whole case on Henry Kalin. I was so armed with my Henry Kalin knowledge that, you know, it makes something sick. But I missed the whole point. So 522G was not tried at the hearing.
I'm not sure what you might indicate. You got your light, my light is my eye.
Something is something, I guess.
All right.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Coleman, you have a little time left. How much?
About 3:37.
Thank you, Your Honor. The record will speak for itself, but I believe the debtor took money out of the $30,000 home safe cash to pay his bankruptcy lawyer. So just remember, you put it on your schedules and you seems to be those facts. Affects credibility. There is no credibility fine. Going back to Law versus Seaman, those portions of Justice Scalia's opinion relating to the objections to exemptions were not necessary to the court's ruling on the surcharge issue that was before the Supreme Court. The issue in this case is procedural. It's the procedural motion to amend. Not file as a motion, but the procedure of amending the schedules to claim additional exemptions.
Does 522G have to be raised as an objection to the exemption, or can it come up later? Like if we just found out about the cash and then we're going to pursue fraudulent transfer, is there a particular time frame under which that has to be raised?
I believe a 522G objection has to be filed within 30 days of the conclusion of the meeting of creditors, or 30 days after the any amendment. And that raises an interesting issue that we believe is applicable. If we have the right, which we believe we do, to object to amended schedule of exemptions on the basis of bad faith, that's issue number one. And then if that motion is granted and that the debtor does have the right to amend the schedules, then we should have an opportunity to look at the specific exemptions that have been claimed, new exemptions, only the new exemptions claimed, and file a 522G objection to that.
So you're saying it's a two-step?
It's a two-step, and that's what Judge Malloy said in the Kalin case. And I don't... I guess someone might say Law versus Siegel does away with that. We think that the Kalin case is procedural. If the Supreme Court in Siegel had intended to address the trustee's right to object to the debtor's claimed exemptions on the basis of fraud, the court would have mentioned 4003B2 specifically says the trustee has the right to object to exemptions on the basis of fraud up to 1 year after the date is closed. So if the Supreme Court approves a bankruptcy rule giving the trustee the authority to do that, and then the argument is, based on Law versus Siegel, that a trustee does not have the right to object to exemptions based on fraud. It makes no sense to interpret Law versus Siegel that way in view of the Supreme Court's own Bankruptcy Rule 1003b2.
Court will be in recess until further notice.